Welcome. Good to see everybody back here, and I'm looking forward to a very spirited presentation and conversation as well. The way we're going to do it tonight is I will speak a little bit, contextualize, then discuss the first of three components of Jerusalem in the modern era, and then we will take a brief break to get some coffee, tea, recharge your batteries, and then we will move into the era of, from 1967 until the present, and then we'll open it up for conversation. So the first thing, though, that I would like you to do is take a brief look at the chronology. Last time, and that's on the handout, last time we stopped in the 1500s when Suleiman, the Ottoman emperor, had rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem and had renewed the glory of the city. But then when he passed away, Jerusalem really gradually became a provincial city in the orbit of the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire itself was very vast and very powerful. It almost conquered Vienna, as those of you may know. But over time, it deteriorated, and along with it, Jerusalem also deteriorated. So take a look, though, to see how much happened. If we move forward into the 19th century, there was a very brief period of Egyptian sovereignty, but effectively speaking, from 1519 until 1917, so an era we had an uninterrupted sovereignty by the Ottoman Empire, which was then interrupted by Western, namely British imperial occupation. So I just want you to have a sense, because I'm not going to go through all of these dates, but they all influence what happens in Jerusalem. All right, so to recall also briefly from the first talk, last time we looked at Jerusalem from the era of Roman sovereignty through the period of the Crusades, as well as the rise of Islam and the conquest of what had become known as Palestine in the 600s, briefly interrupted for about 200 years by the Christian Crusaders. But then in 1297, a renewal of Muslim control, actually under the Mamluks, and then continuing on. So during this vast time period from the Roman era, which let's just say, let's date it around the death of King Herod, Jews were effectively eliminated as power players in the region, and especially in Jerusalem. And not only were they eliminated in terms of political sovereignty and autonomy, which they had lost even before the death of King Herod in 6 CE, but there still was some semblance of Jewish rule, because the temple was in existence. So once the temple, though, was destroyed in 70, and following the subsequent rebellions against the Romans, the Jews were dispersed. Now, there were still Jews always living in what we call the land of Israel, but fewer and fewer. And certainly they were banished in from any kind of control. At the same time, as we discussed last week, in the memory of the Jewish people, expressed primarily through our prayers and Torah reading, so the liturgy, where several times a day we recall Jerusalem, and at Yom Kippur and at Pesach we say next year in Jerusalem, and then the cycle of Torah readings, which recounts the experience of Jews in this land and in exile and in return, the memory of the origins in a particular place and the yearning for a return were kept alive, whether Jews were living in Afghanistan, what is today called Afghanistan, or in Russia, or in France, wherever there were Jewish communities assembled. Okay, and so we have this dichotomy between a people who have been denuded of any kind of authority and even residence, and yet the memory of it stays very much alive. And that is something that we really also need to keep in mind in terms of, if we think to some extent, and we'll discuss this a little later on, of the way that Palestinians view their expulsion and departure from the territory that we now call the State of Israel. There are some strange and disconcerting parallels that that we need to keep in mind, and especially in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem becomes a focal point. Now, another piece to be aware of is, you might say, well, if we kept this memory alive, why didn't we go back earlier? And some of you may be aware, and some of you may not, that the leaders of what comes to be known as Rabbinic Judaism were extremely wary of political adventurism because it had been a disaster under the Romans. In fact, as I mentioned last week, that the Romans referred to Jews as porcupines, that they were seen, and they were, very rambunctious, fairly militaristic, and hostile in many ways to ruling powers. And this eventually created a disaster. And so the newly evolving Judaism turned away from that. And that's one of the reasons why we have this notion that there is to be no mass return until the era of the Messiah. It's only then. That didn't prevent small groups of people or individuals from returning. And there were always waves of people who went to the land of Israel, whether it was the Kabbalists, the exiles from Spain, or groups of Jews from Eastern Europe, or even Germany, but never en masse. And it was a powerful hold. And over that era, starting from 70 and so on, the Jews as a collective group, their profile in the world changes, both internally and externally. And it changes from this porcupine people, so to speak, to the people, which the name was given by the Muslims, the people of the book. That we're a people focused on study and learning. And of course, all of the negatives, some of the negative stereotypes, money lending and all those things. But the notion of a militarized, what the Zionists will call muscular Jews in Judaism, that disappears from the record book. And as well, you have the notion that Christianity and Islam have superseded Judaism, that Judaism is a less than and also untrue revelation of the one God. So it's quite a different profile that we see developing over the several hundred years until we get into the modern era. When we reach the modern era, we have something going on in Europe, and the modern era really starts in Europe and then extends outward. What we have is the development of a new modern nationalism, which posits that there's something called nations, and nations are more important than religions, and you have the development of secularism. And you have in Western Europe this idea that anybody can become part of a nation, like if you're Christian, if you're Muslim, if you're Jewish. I mean, there were debates about it, but that citizenship is determined on an individual basis and your primary loyalty is to the nation. But in Central and Eastern Europe, and this is going to become important, you have a different kind of nationalism, which is one which we call, in the study of nationalism, there's the blood nationalism, or what's it called in French, or state nationalism. Effectively, that in Central and Eastern Europe, you belong to a nation by virtue of your ethnicity. And so it's a bloodline connection. And that is going to be important because in the evolution of Jewish nationalism as it takes place in Palestine, you see the strength of the Central and Eastern European idea, because the dominant Zionists, for the most part, the ones who are able to impose their understanding of nationalism, came from Central and Eastern Europe. And so that's going to play a part. But this emerging nationalism affects the Jews of Europe, and they begin to ask, why not us? If all the peoples of the world are entitled to not only a homeland, but a state, then us too. Now, some argued, no, we don't want it. You saw those. We want to be Americans first, and Jews are Jewish. Jewish is our religion. But others, much more pronounced in Central and Eastern Europe, developed the idea that that the Jewish people is a people like any other, like the French people or the German people or the Polish people, and so we need to have our homeland back, and we need to have a state of our own. And that brings us up to the modern era. So what I would like to begin with is the in 1917. I'm not going to talk here about wars, because today I think it's important for us instead to focus on the social, political, and economic development of Jerusalem beyond just turning point, military turning points. So you might say it would have been natural for me to, let's look at 1917 when the British occupy, let's look at the war of 48, let's look at 67. But we're not going to do it like that, because I think there are other things for us to consider. And what I want to propose to you today is to really think about the social and cultural processes that take place during the era from 1917 to the present that shape what it means for Jews to have political sovereignty and cultural sovereignty in the homeland that had been a memory. And how do we, in this era, after a millennium without having political sovereignty, how do we exercise our power as a people and as a modern state? And I say we because even though I am not an Israeli, I identify with the state of Israel from the point of view of it being a Jewish state. And we can discuss what that means, and we're going to think about what that means. I want you to think about what does it mean to call Israel a Jewish state, as opposed to, for example, like some people I know, I'd like it to be called the state of all, Israel is a state of all its citizens. And what's the difference? All right, so when the British came in, as in the many places that they occupied, they made a mess. So, and I told Ofri, you know, we sort of tear our hair out about what's happening in Israel and in Jerusalem. But I said, you know, if you look at the places where the British Empire functioned, they're all messes, okay? India and Pakistan, very, very dominant. You have an example there. Ireland, 800 years. And it's not resolved, by the way. Okay, those are just two prominent examples. And we could look as well. Now, okay, you could say the United States was an exception. We got off a little early. But in any case, the British found this occupation bewildering and overwhelming. And although they had given the Balfour Declaration, they'd also sent mixed messages to the Arabs by various white papers and agreements. And in addition to which, although there had been in Britain this sort of Philo-Judaism that had developed and a kind of romanticization of the Holy Land, in truth, many of the people who were in the leadership of the British government were anti-Zionist. And especially many of them who were sent over to be in charge of Palestine. Not all, but many of them. And so one of the interesting narratives, divergent narratives that you have between Jews in their study of the history and Arabs is that Jewish historians claim, and there's good substance to it, that the British actually were very anti-Jewish and anti-Zionist, whereas the Arabs will claim that the British were actually very anti-Arab and favored the Jews. And you could pick and choose your arguments. But the fundamental message is that they really made a mess of it. And keep that in mind, that we're still living with the influences of that. The other piece that you want to keep in mind is even though the British came in and took over the area, that the political conception of sovereignty in this area was profoundly influenced by Ottoman conceptions. And a lot of people don't know this, and I want to explain it to you because it's going to influence. It influences even till today what is going on in Jerusalem. All right, so what was that political conception? The Ottomans, and remember, the Ottomans were there for 400 years. So it's not a small period of time. They conceived of society as composed of religious or ethnic communities rather than individuals. Now, that wasn't that uncommon in the Middle Ages, but they were there till 1917, okay? So what does that mean? Among these communities, according to the Ottomans, there's one reigning community. And the government exists mainly for the sake of that reigning dominant community. And that's very important for us to keep in mind. The other communities have the status of minorities. And for the Israelis today, just like as for the Ottomans of the past, it is very important for the dominant group to show the minorities through acts of government who's the ruling community and who's in charge. This is very significant. Now, at the same time, the government will allow the minorities a lot of legal autonomy in matters of personal law, and you see that in effect in Israel today. So, for example, marriages, divorce, they take place within the community rather than between communities. In fact, intermarriage has no legal status in Israel. So that's another piece. So that's very important. Now, the other thing to realize, and this is inherited from the Ottomans as well, that the members of minority communities are, in a very serious way, seen as second-class citizens. And their status is derived from the fact that their community is seen as second-class and marginal. So the whole notion of status is, you know, looms large and is linked to the political attitudes. So why is this significant? Because by now, today in the West, for most of us, the idea has taken hold that a state defines one nationality, okay? And whatever your religious or ethnic affiliation, your primary identification is, I'm an American, I'm a Canadian, I'm a French person, right? That's really not accepted in the Middle East, more broadly speaking. And it's not accepted in Israel either. And it also overlays with that Eastern European notion of nationalism being through the blood. I mean, if you, for example, in Germany, we would call Germany now Western European, but in the era that where nationalism develops, they were really Central European. In Germany, if you might be able to trace your ancestry all the way back, you live in Russia, but you can go back five generations to that they were ethnic Germans who migrated. Boom, you can get citizenship in Germany. Whereas if you're a Turk living in Germany for 50 years now, it's very hard to get citizenship. This is similar, so it crosses over between that Central Eastern European notion of nationalism and the Ottoman notion of communal status, okay? So what happens is that in Israel, there's this sort of confusing rhetoric that I think is difficult for Westerners to really understand, that on the one hand, we use this, Israelis feel that they are modern and part of the West, but the dominant Israeli view about the rights of minorities and majorities, about religion and state and the government, really still are very strongly shaped by the Ottomans. And the British did not change that. They did not influence that, okay? So that's how you see that in Israel, you have groups divided into communities, and it's mainly according to their religion. And they are tolerated or not tolerated according to the Israeli government's judgment of the degree also of threat that they pose to that dominance. So I think this is important for us to consider just in the total picture. The influence, last week we were looking at the influence of earlier generations, and now you're going to see how that's going to play itself out. To some extent in all three of the topics today, but I think especially powerfully in the latter two. Okay, so this is what we're going to do today. The first topic, I would like to discuss with you something that for many may seem irrelevant or off the grid or less than important, but that I actually think is really fascinating as a lens through which we want to view Jerusalem in the modern era. Okay? And that is by looking at the founding and evolution of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Okay? Remember what I told you about how the Jews morphed over time from this porcupine, feisty group into the people of the book. Okay? Zionism sought to, in some ways, rewrite that story, but it never really does in many ways until maybe today. Who knows? And I think that a countercurrent is if we look at the history of the Hebrew University. So let me talk about it a little bit and keep in mind, again, this notion of what does it mean to create a Jewish state? Not only from the point of view of government institutions, but in creating a culture, all right? So Hebrew University, and the word Hebrew is very important here to my mind. And let me explain to you why. I'll explain it as an anecdote. I have a colleague of mine, Alan Mintz, who's a professor of Hebrew literature at Jewish Theological Seminary, very well known. And one time we were sitting at lunch, and we started talking about language and influence, and I said to him, you know, Alan, I just think I said that to him. sometimes it still feels a little bit odd. Some of these people were my teachers, but okay, I try it. I said, I think that the story of Hebrew and the rebirth of Hebrew as a modern language is really just so miraculous. I know it sounds like an absurd comment to make to a professor of Hebrew literature, but I couldn't help it. And he said, well, yeah, he said, I agree with you. And then he said something very fascinating. He said, you know, Hebrew might down the road, we're talking a long time down the road, be seen as the most significant achievement of the Zionist movement. And why is that? One of the reasons why I like my colleagues at JTS. He said, you know, territoriality, don't know how successful that's been. But language, we have. Massive modern Hebrew literature, modern press, modern cinema, modern theater. And that is miraculous if you think that when we go back to the Roman era, Jews were not talking Hebrew in that time period, already from the beginnings. So that we have 2,000 years later a vibrant Hebrew language that not only Jews study, by the way, is in some ways very powerful. So the fact that it was called not the Jewish University, but Hebrew University, is already saying something very significant. All right. So this idea was already proposed in 1884. There was a conference of sort of the proto-Zionist movement called Chovevei Zion, or Lovers of Zion. And they held a conference in Katowice, which is in Poland. And that was in 1884. Again, at the first Zionist Congress in 1897, this was proposed. People wanted to put a modern university. The Zionists felt that this was a priority. Okay? A group of young Zionists headed by Chaim Weizmann, who was a scientist and who was a professor at the University of Geneva, decided to make that a primary aim of the Zionist movement. Okay? To put that at the centerpiece. And in addition to him, you had other really luminaries, not only of the Jewish world, but of the wider world of European culture, like Martin Buber, who decided to act on this. And again, it was put forth in 1901 at the next Zionist Congress, to the point that Herzl then submitted a petition to the Ottoman Sultan to establish a university in Jerusalem. And 10 years later, in 1913, a committee was appointed that included Weizmann and Judah Magnus, who was a Reform rabbi from the United States, to execute the project. They got approval from the Sultan to put into creation a Hebrew university. But World War I interrupted things. However, during the war, towards the end, Weizmann went to Palestine as part of the Zionist Commission. And once the Balfour Declaration was declared, they were able to really put into progress the establishment of the university. And by 1918, in July, even before the end of the war, 12 tribes. 12 foundation stones were laid on Mount Scopus, which was north of the old city. Now, how'd they get to site, which is quite impressive for those of you who've been there? Okay. Before the war happened, there was a Vilna Zionist leader, okay, who was one of the founders of Haaretz, the newspaper that still exists today, named Isaac Goldberg, good Jewish name, who moved to Palestine in 1919. But before that, he had actually bought the estate of an Englishman who had owned that property, an Englishman named Sir John Grey Hill. So he bought it outright, and that's what became the foundation of the Hebrew University. So at that, it wasn't really an opening so much as a foundation stone. Weizmann, who was the only speaker of the ceremony, this is what he spoke at the time. So this is July 1918. Here, out of the misery and the desolation of war, is being created the first germ of a new life. In this university, we have gone beyond restoration. We are creating during the war something which is to serve as symbol of a better future. In the university, the wandering soul of Israel will reach its haven. All right. Now, 7 years passed before any real faculty could open. So that's 1925. But be aware that in 1923, the first lecture was given by Albert Einstein. In Hebrew, the first couple of sentences, all right, which they had determined would be the language of teaching. And by the way, this was not a given. In fact, at the Technion, there were riots because the Technion had argued that German should, some had argued that German should be the language, but the Hebraicists fought it. They went on strike. They campaigned radically so that Hebrew was instituted as the language of higher education well before we had a state of Israel. Okay, very important. And Einstein was so in favor of this idea of the Hebrew University that he actually traveled with Weizmann across the United States in 1921 to try to raise funds. Okay, now, before they opened up an undergraduate division, they decided that there should be postgraduate research and scientific research. Okay, so what you had at the beginning was three tiny research: Jewish studies, chemistry, and microbiology. And that, what was this? There were two directions that the founders envisioned. On the one hand, the Hebrew University will be a center where the Hebrew tradition would be molded in its original language and in light of the general humanities. So it wasn't to be exclusively devoted to Judaica. And on the other hand, it should be a center of research in the natural and medical sciences to help the regeneration of the land of Israel, as the Zionists perceived it as being significant. So finally, in 1925, Arthur Balfour, who was the famous leader of the Balfour Declaration, was formally opened. You had the High Commissioner, who was a Jew, Sir Herbert Samuel. You had General Allenby and Chaim Weizmann. And you had the luminaries of the Zionist movement, Nachman Bialik, Achad Ha'am, and the Chief Rabbi Cook. Okay, and they all came to this ceremony. Significantly, the government, the British government, gave no money to this. Okay? It was exclusively the financial responsibility of worldwide Jewry. So it was the Jewish people around the world who were supposed to do it, and the leadership was made up of eminent Jews from around the world. So it wasn't only if you live in the land in Palestine that you can be a part of this. It was this notion that the entire Jewish people is moving towards the establishment of this modern university. Once the university was inaugurated, they added various departments. Very quickly, by 1931, you had Jewish studies, Oriental studies, mathematics, general humanities, philosophy, history, geography, archaeology, classical literature, English, other language, physics, and biological sciences. And by 1931, you had degrees being already awarded, and you already had the push to have undergraduates. Interestingly, they resisted the idea of establishing professional schools yet. And I think some of you may have heard of this notion in Hebrew called Torah Lishma, which is the study of Torah for its own sake. That there isn't any outcome that needs to be shown on the ground. And interestingly, when we talk about the way religious notions get transported in Israel into more secular ones and in the Zionist movement, the decision was made: no law school originally and no medical school. Why? Learning should be acquired for its own sake, and research was the main objective. So you have this interesting transformation of the notion of the love, learning for its own sake or for the sake of heaven, to learning for the beauty of learning. And half of the students came from Palestine and half of them were from abroad. All right. So now I want to just share two anecdotes with you that I think are quite intriguing and revealing about some of the contradictions and tensions. So I don't know whether these are true. They might be apocryphal, but one of them is actually quite true, but the other one we don't know for sure, but it's sort of out there, and I think it's illustrative. So one has to do with Spinoza. So many of you will know that Spinoza was, the famous Spinoza in Amsterdam, and he was one of the Jews who they put a ban on him. Because of his publications, the leadership of the Amsterdam community in the 1600s, what's called a cherem, they kicked him out. Okay? They went to him and said, "Do not publish. You can think whatever you want." They appealed to him. "You can think what you want, but don't put it in writing." And interestingly enough, Spinoza waited till his father died before he published his his major treaties and books. But once he published them, he was seen as so threatening that they actually in those days kicked him out. Well, there is a story that says that once the Hebrew University was established, at some point there was a ceremony held on Mount Scopus for Spinoza to, by the leadership, to welcome him back, to lift the cherem and bring him back into the fold of Jewish scholars and intellectuals. There's one rumor. Now, the other one is not a rumor, it's actually true. So many of you have heard of Martin Buber. He was the great German Jewish thinker. And he stayed in Germany all the way until 1938. He became the de facto spiritual leader of German Jewry as they were dealing with, you know, the shutdown, the elimination, the marginalization, and then the elimination, and then the annihilation of German Jewry. But he was also a famous Zionist, not a political Zionist, but a cultural Zionist. And people were frustrated that he wouldn't go to Palestine. But finally, when the situation got so bad, he knew he needed to leave with his wife and his family. And he wanted to have a position as a professor of religion at Hebrew University, the Department of Religion. I mean, he's an unbelievable religious scholar. Well, guess what? Already, the ultra-Orthodox within the Jerusalem and the what's called the Yeshuv, they had enough power that they blocked the appointment of Buber to the faculty, to the Department of Religion. Which is why, if you read the history, Martin Buber is not on the religious studies or the religion department of Hebrew University. He was put on in the sociology department. And he was very frustrated by that. But here you have this tension emerging. You have a secular university where the ultra-Orthodox are able to clamp down because Buber, like Spinoza, was seen as such a radical. Not for his political beliefs, because of his religious writings. So that's something important. Now, the Nazi persecution of the Jews in Germany, tragically, but in some ways beneficially, had the effect of creating a mass exodus, and many of the German Jewish intellectuals did go to Palestine. And so Hebrew University now becomes a center where all these world-renowned German Jewish intellectuals are centered. And it became part of the battle for academic freedom in the world. So Hebrew University, this, you know, little dumpy place in some ways, now becomes a beacon and a symbol of the fight against Nazi oppression not only of Jews, but elsewhere. And also Hebrew still is the language of instruction, okay? And at this point, you see the way that the Hebrew University contributes massively to the creation of modern Hebrew, okay? Because you have these scholars who are building up a vocabulary based on biblical and rabbinical Hebrew to make modern Hebrew sensible. All these words and concepts and ideas need to have expression. And so Hebrew University is a centerpiece. And one of the other ways that they become a centerpiece of Hebrew is because they create a library called the Jewish National Library, which quickly grew to 500,000 books. Okay? And by 1920, it's considered already there were collections beginning. So even before the founding of the university, you had these collections. And today, of course, it has the largest collection of Hebraica and Judaica in the whole world. Okay? But it doesn't only have that. You have, for example, many prominent people who've left their papers. So, for example, Albert Einstein left all of his personal papers and the intellectual copyright to the Hebrew University. And so you have 55,000 items from Einstein's archives. And in 2012, it had digitized the entire archive to make available to everybody around the world. So spreading knowledge that is Jewish and that extends beyond the Jewish world, because Einstein, although proudly Jewish, his work is not primarily Jewish. All right, it's scientific. So that's another piece. The other issue is the establishing of a hospital, we all know, and the significance of that hospital in helping during the war, by the way, to provide relief to the Allies in their fight in the Middle East, okay? Now, the years from 1945 to 1948 were very troubled.
There were violent attacks. There was a famous and tragic attack on doctors during the 48 war. Doctors and nurses were in a convoy, and they were attacked by Arabs, and about 88 of them were killed. So it's also the scene, and becomes the scene of a lot of fighting. And during the era of the division of the city, there were three campuses established. So now you have two sections, which were in the western part of Israel, one in Rehovot, and then the Mount Scopus was off limits. And so there were all these shenanigans going on where the Israeli government would appeal to the international world and to the Jordanians that they needed to go and do this and that. But in fact, there were a lot. They would go and get books. All of the books were transferred, but they would also do other things like scope out the territory. So Mount Scopus becomes part of East Jerusalem and part of Jordanian Jerusalem. But the university itself becomes like a university without walls in that it moves to other parts. It's not destroyed. Okay, so I'm gonna finish up with this understanding of the significance of the Hebrew University to Jerusalem. Obviously, you see it becoming an intellectual center for the renewal of modern Jewish life. But at the same time, it's not only modern Jewish life modern Jewish life broadly speaking. Today, close to 40% of all civilian research carried out in the country in Israel is conducted at Hebrew University. Okay. Also, it has become a center for all of the high-tech firms. So you see now, again, how this conception of what does it mean to have a Jewish state and Jewish culture, this moving back and forth between the Jewish orientation and an opening to the larger world. Okay. You also have important and little known facts that the university was pioneer in establishing contacts with Palestinian scholars and research from Arab countries. You have the Harry Truman Peace Center. You have the Study for the Infectious and Tropical Diseases, the Faculty of Agriculture working across borders, joint research projects, regional economics, water usage, environmental quality, tolerance education, animal and human diseases that are endemic to the region. So all of these things are quietly happening, which you don't see in the newspapers and in the news, happening at the Hebrew University. And by 2005, there were 8 faculties. And I'm going to close this section, and then we can take a little break, that from the Hebrew University, there are 90,000 alumni around the world today. Okay? 11 professional libraries. The Hebrew University, 100 research centers. So if we think about the birth of a Jewish state, we need to think about the role of Hebrew University. And we'll talk about that later. So now let's take a break, get your beverages and other things. Take a few minutes.